Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Darfur. And our guest is Mahmoud Mamdani. He's a professor of government and a member of several departments, anthropology, political science, Middle East and Asian languages and cultures, and the School of International and Public Affairs, all at Columbia University. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his recent book, Saviors and Survivors. The subtitle is Darfur, Politics and the War on Terror. It's published by Pantheon. He makes the argument that the region has seen an insurgency and a brutal counterinsurgency, but not, as many people argue, a genocide. And this has made him and his view somewhat controversial. He says he believes that the current conflict in Darfur has deep roots in colonialism, in the Cold War, in the War on Terror. And he also has been critical of those people who have called for an armed intervention in Darfur. He says he believes there can, in fact, be a resolution to the problems of Darfur, but not by military means. As we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and also toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, certainly questions and comments from listeners are welcome. Professor Mamdani, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I think as a way of starting out, I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about perhaps why it is that Darfur has gotten so much attention, and I don't mean to suggest that it shouldn't have gotten attention, but if you look around the world at places where there are conflict, there's certainly plenty of conflict around the world, and so one wonders why it is that sometimes certain things get a lot of attention and other things don't. And certainly there are other places in Africa that one might look to focus your attention. Why do you think it is that so much attention has been devoted to Darfur?
It's actually one of the first questions that struck me. I went to Sudan in 2003 to do research on Sudan as part of a larger project I was doing on Sudan in Nigeria. And it's the same year the insurgency began in Sudan, in Darfur. I noticed very soon after, because my work is mainly focused on Africa in the colonial period and the post-colonial period, and I had written a book on the Rwandan genocide, and I was familiar with Angola, and I was familiar with Eastern Congo, and I noticed that there was something very different about the international reporting on Darfur. All the other African conflicts seemed to have occurred as if it were in the dead of the night, more or less unnoticed by the international media. Darfur was very different. Darfur became a media item very soon. In fact, it seemed there was a media hype on Darfur, and I wondered why. And the answer was not difficult. It was clear that the reason lay in the fact that Darfur had become the focus of a major social mobilization in the United States. It became the focus of an organization in the U.S., a loose sort of confederation of called Save Darfur. And it had become a domestic issue in the U.S. This, it seemed to me, was the explanation of why Darfur had become so salient in the media.
And why, then, maybe the question would be of those people who really embrace this issue, those people, and certainly there have been high-profile individuals and some well-known journalists who have said repeatedly, very strongly, this is very serious, it deserves the world's attention, we ought to do something about this. What I suppose the question still stands, well, why Darfur and not someplace else?
Well, I didn't think there was a single reason for this. I thought that that those who were in the leadership of the Save Darfur movement seemed to come from different places. There were those who came from a history of solidarity with the struggle in South Sudan. Some of them came from the Christian churches, others came from even Congress. They assumed that Darfur was simply another version of South Sudan. If there had been a slavery in South Sudan, which was Arab slavery and African victims, there must have been a similar slavery in Darfur. But in fact, there wasn't. The slavers, the slave masters in Darfur were four, not Arab. And they assumed that if the Southern Sudan conflict had begun as a regional revolt against an oppressive central government, the Darfur conflict must have had the same origins. But I realized that, of course, it didn't. The Darfur conflict began as an internal civil war, and that made all the difference. Another group which was very active in mobilizing around Darfur was a group that had no historical connection with Sudan or Darfur, but was itself activated by the 10th anniversary commemoration of the genocide in Rwanda. And this is the group which argued that the key lesson of Rwanda was that faced with violence of genocidal proportions, you don't ask questions. You don't try to find out why. This is the group that said that, you know, while we stopped to ask to find out who was a Hutu and who was a Tutsi in Rwanda, and why the Hutu were killing the Tutsi, the Tutsi were dead. There are times, not every time, but there are times when you must not stop to find out why. You must just act. But then, of course, the question is, how do you know this is the time when you mustn't ask what is going on and you must just act? And the answer is, of course, you're told that this is the time. Then who tells you? Whoever tells you has to know before they act. So I thought that this was a curious way of leaving the monopoly of knowledge into very few hands by evoking the human condition that knowledge is always imperfect. But the fact that knowledge is always imperfect is no reason to do away with knowledge. It's like saying to a doctor rushed to a scene of a critical illness, don't diagnose, just prescribe. Well, who would accept that? Mm-hmm. Or it's like telling even going a step further and saying that to those most concerned in outrage should prescribe, that you don't need any expertise to prescribe, any knowledge to prescribe. And I thought there was a third group. The real tragedy of Darfur, I think, was that, or is that, it happened after 9/11. So that it was not only the diagnosis, but the prescription was also filtered through lenses crafted in 9/11, through neocon lenses. And strangely enough, both the prescription of the Save Darfur movement and the prescription of the al-Bashir regime in Khartoum have this curious similarity. And the similarity is this, that if the problem is violence, then the solution must be more violence. Sort of is the solution has to be to do away with the perpetrator in a way. So the regime in Khartoum mounted its own little war on terror in Darfur. This brutal assault justified as a counterinsurgency in 2003-2004, and the Save Darfur movement also proceeded with the assumption that the problem was internal and the solution would have to be external, and the external solution would have to call for some kind of an intervention, boots on the ground, out of Iraq into Darfur, no-fly zone. At different points, these were different kinds of solutions presented to the problem in Darfur. But I thought that the underlying assumptions, the assumptions shared with the war on terror, went deeper, which was that if you go to a Save Darfur website, you will see a sort of graphic portrayal of terror, in the sense of killings, rape, burnings of villages, even video games about children outside a camp who go to look for firewood or water and are surrounded by Janjaweed, and you're asked to figure out how this child is going to escape, things like that. But you will find, curiously, there's no dateline, and you will find that there is no attempt to give an explanation of the violence. There's no history, there's no politics, there are no issues. The assumption is that the violence is its own explanation. It's not driven by any issues. Now, this is the core assumption of the war on terror. If in the face of the war on terror, should you say that, no, there are issues and we must address the issues, it would be taken as an apology. The assumption is violence drives itself. Some people are just genetically violent, and the thing to do is to do away with them. And Save Darfur, one of the critical participants in it was, I believe, a section of the human rights movement, which shares this assumption that all you have to do is to catalog atrocities, to identify the perpetrator and the victim, and name it and shame the perpetrator. And that is all. Demonize the perpetrator. Isolate the perpetrator, preferably even eliminate the perpetrator. But that doesn't do it, because there is no ahistorical perpetrator and there's no ahistorical victim. Usually the problems in these situations, including Rwanda, is that victims and perpetrators have traded places. And why have they traded places? What are the underlying issues that tend to be historically reproduced? These are the questions I was interested in. How do you stop the cycle of violence? How do you make sure that if the victim of today should emerge victorious tomorrow, the demonized perpetrator does not emerge as the victim in the next cycle of violence? How do you make sure of that? And I thought the important thing was to put the conflict in Darfur, to take it out of its completely detached position without history, without politics, and to reattach it to its context, to its history and politics. So I spent a lot of the book doing that. And then in the third section of the book, I then explained this conflict in terms that made sense historically and politically.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mahmoud Hamdani. He is professor of government and a member of the Departments of Anthropology, Political Science, Middle East and Asian Languages and Cultures, and the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. He is author of the book Saviors and Survivors, Darfur Politics and the War on Terror. It's published by Pantheon. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think what you've said, you've made this very strong argument that says if you're going to understand the causes of violence even before And if you're going to contemplate some sort of intervention, you at the very least should understand the causes of the violence and the historical context that's the underpinning of all of that. And I think that you have also said that really you have to look on a number of levels, that the colonial experience makes a contribution, that the Cold War makes an experience makes a contribution, that the War on Terror makes a contribution. And maybe we can talk a little bit about each of those things, beginning with the colonial experience. And I think that what you say is that in part, the situation that we see today was the result of the tendency of a colonial power. In this case, it was Britain, and in other places, colonial powers have done the same thing, where they've come into a place and they, and as a part of their ruling strategy, have divided people into groups and into categories and into classes, artificial ones that didn't really exist before, but have divided people and then created a basis for further kind of divisions that come later that can then lead to conflict. Because, and ultimately, I guess it's because people are fighting over whatever resources there are.
Right. Well, you know, if you look at the origin of this conflict, the conflict has unfolded over several phases. The first phase was 1987-1989. Now, before 87, there were conflicts in Darfur, but most of the history will tell you that most of the conflicts were really sort of local conflicts between neighbors, around land, but around on the question of boundaries, and they were relatively easily settled through reconciliation conferences. Something changed in 1987. The conflict that began in 1987 was a conflict which became all Darfur almost immediately. It was at the same time a conflict which saw unparalleled levels of violence and brutality. And people asked why. There were several reasons for this. Just a minute, let me close this door. There were several reasons for this. The deep historical reason had to do with the British Cold War, the British colonial period, and the ways in which the colonial period reshaped the relationship to land and administration in Darfur. The British divided Darfur into tribal homelands. And in each tribal homeland, they made a distinction between native and settler tribes. So one tribe was acknowledged as native, and all the others thereby became settlers. Now, the advantage of being acknowledged or designated a native tribe were two. The first, you got a customary a right of access to land. And anybody else living in the area who wanted to access land would have to pay a tribute, usually around 10% of what they produced on the land. The second advantage you got was an administrative advantage, that the local administration of the area, which would be carried out by chiefs, that the chiefs would only be appointed from the native tribe, not from the settler tribes. So you tribe became not simply an identity, but it became actually like race in the urban areas. Tribe in the rural areas became a form of discrimination, an institutionalized, legally enforced form of discrimination. Now, this is the background. Then comes a second cause, which is a period of four decades of drought and desertification. The Sahara, the southern rim of the Sahara, expands by 100 kilometers over four decades. This comes to its sort of final a cumulative impact in the mid-80s. And as the Sahara pushes southwards, it pushes the northern nomadic camel tribes down south. And as the nomadic tribes move down south, they head for the best land, which is declared, has been declared a tribal homeland of several peasant tribes. And there ensues a classic ecological conflict between nomadic and peasant tribes over the best land. And then comes a third contributing cause, which comes out of the Cold War, because Darfur is neighbor to Chad, and in Chad there has been a civil war going on for roughly 40 years. In the mid-80s, this civil war gets incorporated into the Cold War as the Reagan administration comes into power in the U.S. The Reagan administration, along with France and Israel, arm one side in the Chadian civil war. Gaddafi and the Soviet Union arm another side. So while one side is in government in N'Djamena, the capital of Chad, the other side, the opposition, crosses the border into Darfur, and they mobilize and arm and train in Darfur, and from Darfur they launch invasions into Chad. So in the process, there's a spillover into Darfur. Darfur becomes militarized. It is very similar to what happens to Eastern Congo in relationship to Rwanda. After the genocide, the opposition in Rwanda crosses the border into Eastern Congo, where it arms and mobilizes, and where it is armed and mobilized by its benefactors from the outside, and Eastern Congo becomes militarized in the process. So by the mid-80s, when there isn't a drop of water in Darfur, Darfur is awash with guns, especially the ubiquitous AK-47. And this explains the consequences of the violence, which used to be carried out by much more modest means before, cruder and elementary means before, is now carried out with modern warfare. So my point here is that the big powers in the world got involved in the Darfur conflict in the mid-80s, long before the government of Sudan got involved. The critique of the government of Sudan was that it wasn't involved, and before the present government came into power in Sudan. The present government came into power at the end of that first phase of conflict in 1989. So whereas obviously the responsibility for the kind of brutality and violence unleashed by this government in 2003-2004 is rightly put at its doorstep, it is not the alone. It's not the only one that should be held responsible for what's happened in Darfur. We have to begin with the big powers. Secondly, if we realize that the conflict began as a conflict around land, and the charges of genocide were made as early as the Reconciliation Conference in 1989 by one side, which in fact uses the word Holocaust in the transcript of that conference, and the other side was claiming to be the victim of ethnic cleansing. We have to recognize that both sides are talking about a conflict over land, not an attempt to eliminate any group as a group, but a conflict over land triggered by an ecological disaster and fed by an intervention of big foreign powers.
And just to underscore one point here, that people sometimes they seem to have seen this conflict as something that involved indigenous people and outsiders. And it seems that if what is you were saying is that in fact that this original conflict, the battle over land, that was not indigenous people and outsiders, that all of the people who were the party to that conflict, the people who were fighting over the land, were all Darfur people. It wasn't like they had come from someplace else.
Right. Well, you know, I was struck. Everything I read, not only the media reports and not only Save Darfur publications or messages, but also a lot of the scholarly writing shared this assumption of a conflict between Arabs and Africans, and the assumption that Arabs are settlers who came in from the Middle East at some point, even with a thick history kind of in Sudan, and Africans are indigenous. So I began to go further back into history and read the stuff to see if this was true. And I realized actually that there are two different interpretations. That one, the dominant interpretation, comes from British colonial historians in the early 20th century. And ironically, it is almost wholly embraced by nationalist historians of Sudan. And this is a history which explains developments in Sudan as the result of a civilizing mission from the outside. And imagine, you know, it takes northern Sudan, Nubia, has a history, you know, written history of 6,000 years, one of the longest recorded histories in the world. And it explains this entire history as the result of different waves of civilization from the outside. So the first wave is the pharaonic, and the second wave is the Byzantine Christian, and the third wave is the Arab Muslim, and the fourth wave is the British colonial. And I realized, of course, that focusing on this Arab-Muslim wave, I realized there had been no Arab invasion of Sudan. And then I began to look for evidence of immigration, because the assumption was that the Arabs immigrated into Sudan. They cohabitated or married local people and was born this kind of hybrid or bastard, depending on your point of view, race, which are the Arabs of Sudan today. But as I looked for evidence of migration, the greatest migration had been to Nubia and Beja in eastern Sudan, but those people had even forgotten their language and changed their way of life from nomadism into farming. So where did these Arabs come from? This was my question. And then I got into other literature, from folklore to alternate histories written in the 60s and 70s, local histories. And I realized that different groups became Arabs at different times. That in the 16th century, the royalty in this part of the world claimed to have come from the Holy Land, from the Ethiopian kings who claimed to be related to King Solomon, to all the Muslim royalty who claimed to have descended from the house of the Prophet. Then the merchants in the 18th century, when they came into conflict with the royalty, because towns were growing and new conflicts were brewing in towns from the marketplace, and the question was, how do you settle conflicts in the marketplace? The king said, custom, and the merchant said, no, we're not parochial people, we're not just local, we have a cosmopolitan vision. And a cosmopolitan vision in the 18th century was identified with the identity Arab, and the merchants claimed to be Arab. So when they said they were Arab, they didn't come from anywhere. They were as local as anybody else. Then in the anti-colonial period, popular classes joined this identity Arab. And if you read histories of those who were enslaved in the central part of Sudan, you will recognize that many of those, after the end of slavery, became Arab. Just as if you look at those enslaved in Darfur, many of them became poor after slavery. Then I finally realized that, of course, the Arabs tribes of Darfur had nothing to do with this history I'd been reading of the Arabs of the River Nile. That these, in contrast to the Arabs of River Nile and Khartoum and these areas, the Arabs of Darfur are not privileged groups. They have no relationship to power. They are, in fact, the poorest of the poor in Darfur, whether you take income or employment or number of professionals. They are the worst off. That they have been nomads, and they have historically moved in sort of southern rim of the Sahara, between the southern rim of the Sahara and the northern part of the equator, where the tsetse fly zone stops. So they've moved from Darfur going towards West Africa and North Africa with the seasons and with the march of seasons. So I realized there's no single history of Arab, and that these are African Arabs. These guys didn't come from the Middle East. Mm. They're as native as anybody else.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mahmoud Mamdani. He's professor of government and member of the Departments of Anthropology, Political Science, Middle East and Asian Languages and Cultures, and the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. And he is author of the book, Saviors and Survivors, Darfur Politics and the War on Terror, and it's published by Pantheon. We have several callers here. We want to get them into the conversation. Let's take them in the order that they came in, and we'll start with line number one. This is someone who is in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Given the complex Arab history that you've just outlined, could we jump to the present and ask about the involvement of the Israel lobby and the U.S. with the Save Darfur movement?
Yeah, go ahead. Look, I don't know if I have much information on, mm-hmm. on the issue that you're interested in. Let me sort of put on the table what I do know. It is interesting that the alarm, the whistle that a genocide was unfolding in Darfur was blown first by the Holocaust Museum in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. And it is also interesting that this is the first time the Holocaust Museum identified a particular violence as genocide. It is also interesting, I think, the Save Darfur begins initially as an interfaith coalition of religious groups, and this is a coalition of sort of right-wing churches and right-wing Zionist groups. It's a coalition that grows. In its first rallies, this coalition produced what they called faith packets. So they would have Christian faith packets, Jewish faith packets, and Muslim faith packets, and interfaith packets. And the Christian faith packet told the reader that the Lord had empowered Christians to lead humanity. And the Jewish faith packet told its readers that the Lord had given Jews through history the particular facility to identify genocide wherever it occurs. And the Muslim faith packet told Muslims that you are particularly well-placed to identify the perpetrators of genocide. So the Christians were supposed to be the drivers, and the Jews the navigators, and the Muslims presumably informers, since they lived amongst those who were carrying out genocide. Now, the best source I found, and I don't have it before me here, but it's footnoted in my book. The best source on the involvement of Zionist organizations in Save Darfur is an article in the Jerusalem Post, where the author talks of the early beginnings of Save Darfur movement and links it to particular groups. But I didn't, you know, I was more interested in the kind of assumptions and worldview of Save Darfur movement than following its particular links.
Thank you very much for your work. It's very important.
All right, let's continue. We have another caller. This is also someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello. Well, I guess they changed their mind. We'll go to, how about Champaign, line three. Hello.
Hello, is that me?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to pass on a quick comment and maybe a suggestion. When you explain the issues in Darfur and the reasons why those people are fighting each other to Americans, I think one analogy that springs to my mind that really explains it best is to draw upon Rodgers and Hammerstein's play Oklahoma. It's the farmers and the cowmen who are at each other's throats. It doesn't have anything to do with religion. It doesn't have anything to do with ethnicity.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I would just add one thing to it. You're right. It is farmers and cowmen, but as those directly involved in the fighting appeal to bystanders, they have to couch the appeal in terms other than.
Yes, right. Well, I'm talking about someone who wants to understand it more from a neutral perspective.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, again, thank you for the call. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I think that at least my understanding was that one reason that there was this big increase in the conflict was when the government of Sudan became involved, and that the explanation was that we had indigenous groups in Darfur that felt that they and their issues weren't getting the attention that they should from the government, that there had been this settlement of this long-running civil war, and that people were starting to benefit from this period of peace, and that the people in Darfur were not. And so the insurgents there, one of the things that they were interested in was getting the attention of the government in Khartoum. And that when they started to attack the interests of the government, that was at that point that the government turned around and through the Janjaweed started to make war, started to launch this counterinsurgency. Is that not the way things went?
Yes, but I'd like to elaborate on that.
Yes, please.
Look, when the settlement in the south happens, there are people on both sides unhappy with the settlement. There is a section of the Islamist government in Khartoum, which is unhappy, and it breaks off. This is the more ideological civilian section, and the military, less ideological, continues in power. Then in the SPLA in the south also, there are those who are unhappy. Particularly, those identified with John Garang, who had a more sort of all Sudan picture of the change that needs to come, and who was unhappy with simply the southern nature of the settlement. So the, I would say the more ideological sections on both sides were unhappy. At the same time, inside Darfur, the civil war, which had begun in 1987-89, hadn't been solved. It had re-erupted in the 1990s as the government at the center came in to give land, to take some land away from the peasants and give it to the nomads who had no land, re-triggering sort of the civil war. But it had been simmering. Now, these two groups come together in 2003, that period. And the militias in one side of the civil war, which have been tribal militias, as they connect, one connects with the SPLA in the south, the other connects with the Islamist opposition in Khartoum, and as they connect, their vision expands. And from tribal militias, they become rebel movements. They speak a different language, but their sociology is the same. Their base of support is still the particular tribes, same as what had been in 1987-89. And the rebellion begins. And when the rebellion begins, the government realizes that it is going to be difficult for it to counter this rebellion militarily because most of it is most of its army is recruited from Darfur. Not the officer corps, but the ordinary soldiers, and not recruited, but actually drafted from Darfur, and they simply were not sure they could rely on this army. So they identify the other group in the civil war, the nomads, and they decide to arm the nomads. So in a way, this is the third time the civil war is triggered again. And the nomadic drive now against their old adversaries is identified, is given this name, Janjaweed, which is a name which earlier was used for sort of outlaw bandits in a zone of expanding desert, semi-eroded or eroded land, highway bandits and unemployed youth and stuff like that. And now that term is used for the entire nomadic tribes of northern Darfur. And it serves not only to demonize them, but it serves to justify their exclusion from all the negotiations, peace negotiations that happen later on, and creates one of the major problems that needs to be settled now. The next thing that happens is at the end of 2004, as the Save Darfur publicity picks up, and as global attention begins to focus on Sudan, I would say legitimately in that period when this horrible violence in Darfur, the Sudan government realizes that it's not in its interest to have this alliance with one side in the civil war. And the Arab nomads realize that it's not in their interest either to be with the government of Sudan, because the government would just drop them at the first chance when they thought it necessary to drop them. Beginning 2005, the level of violence drops in Darfur. It drops dramatically. The UN reports say, you know, 4 days ago, the UNAMID commander and the Secretary General, UN Secretary General's representative in Sudan, gave a report to the Security Council. And in that report, for the first time, he gave figures on how many civilians have been killed in Darfur from January 2008 to March 2009. And according to his report, the monthly average is between 135 and 150. He said, this is not an emergency. This is a low-intensity conflict now. And you would never hear that. Even the New York Times hit it somewhere on page, I don't know what, in a column. But you would never see this in the media. The fact is, from early 2005, the level of violence has been low. There has been an opportunity for a political solution, but the opportunity has been wasted by giving it a hype, continuing genocide, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. These are the phrases that are used. Instead of underlining the progress that has taken place over the last 4 years.
Yeah. We're coming to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes. And just as a way of trying to finish up, because I know that you have said, when we look at conflicts like this, we make the assumption that this is an internal problem, but that there should be an external solution. That is, the rest of the world is going to come in and we're going to solve the problem. And you have argued very strongly against an armed intervention. So if what we hope we might do would be to facilitate a peaceful and external and internal solution, are there some things that you think that the rest of the world could do that would be productive?
Look, African conflicts show us two kinds of way out. In the most intractable conflicts, like, for example, Sierra Leone, or even Darfur, 2004-2005. You know, there was an external intervention in Darfur, which was by the African Union. And the African Union went in with a clear understanding that the point of its intervention was not the number of soldiers and the military equipment. It wasn't going to fight the different sides in the civil war, but the point of its intervention would be to bring together the different sides to facilitate a political solution. The not the African Union, but the West African states went into Sierra Leone and had the same perspective. And my argument is that if there has to be an external intervention, it should be by your peers, by those who can put themselves in your shoes, and by your neighbors, those who can't run away, those who have to face the consequences of their own actions. It shouldn't be like the U.S. in Afghanistan, and once the Soviets are gone, they go off until the consequences reach New York, and then they come back again. So it has to be preferably a regional. But the better outcome is the one actually of apartheid, the end of apartheid in South Africa, where the solution was an internal solution. And the solution was to recognize that actually we have a choice between either holding individuals responsible criminally by taking them to court. So you could have taken the leaders of apartheid to court, but then you wouldn't have had their cooperation in ending apartheid. So the alternative was not to take them to court, but to have a political reform which ends apartheid. So are you going to hold the leaders of apartheid responsible, or are you going to end apartheid? That was the choice, and the answer was very clear. Same thing in Mozambique. When this conflict was going on, when you had Renamo, which specialized in abducting children and then introducing these children to terror, so you had child terrorists who were at the same time both victims and perpetrators, they today sit in parliament. And the precondition was give up violence. If you can get votes, you sit in parliament. Same thing South Sudan. That's how South Sudan was ended. Nobody was taken to court. So why not Darfur? That's my question in the book. Why can't we resolve Darfur the way we resolved apartheid, South Sudan, Mozambique? Because this insistence on an external solution only strengthens hardliners on both sides. It strengthens those in the rebel movement who think they just have to sit it out and power will fall in their lap. And it strengthens those in the government who think that any concession, any negotiation will just take them on a slippery slope which will end up with regime change. Hmm. Well, I think it's about time we changed our mode of operation here.
And here, again, maybe we have about a minute or two. I would expect that you would say that the charges that have been made against the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur, in charges made in the International Criminal Court about 2 months ago, you would say that that's not productive?
Well, I would say that, look, the core of those charges, which is what happened in 2003-2004, that's real. There's a lot of beefing of things. I would say the attributing of responsibility for it to one man presumes a strong state which simply doesn't exist. You know, on the one hand, you have the accusations of a failed state. On the other hand, you're talking of a state where you can give an order at the top and everything happens at the bottom. It's simply not true. If you read the testimony of Bush's envoy to Sudan, Andrew Natsios, to Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he keeps on telling them in early 2008 that, look, the government has no control here. This territory is beyond its control. But my final point is basically that we have a choice. Do we want to take Bashir or other individuals to court, or do we want their cooperation in a political settlement? I think the latter.
Yeah. Our guest, Mahmoud Mamdani, is Herbert Lehman Professor of Government and a member of the Departments of Anthropology, Political Science, and Middle East and Asian Languages and Cultures, as well as the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. And if you'd like to read more of his thoughts on this subject, look for his book, Saviors and Survivors, Darfur Politics and the War on Terror. It's published by Pantheon Books. Professor Mamdani, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.